Hello, and welcome to the Talking Information Center's reading of the Guidepost Magazine for the spring of 2025. Here's Heidi with the first story.
Our first story is Under New Beginnings. What will people think of me? No one likes being judged, but sometimes the fear of judgment goes so deep that it holds us back from living the life to the fullest. By Diane Stark of Brazil, Indiana. I set my paper plate of tacos on the folding table in our church fellowship hall and smiled at the woman who made them for the six families in our life group that Tuesday. "Thanks for cooking tonight," I said, hoping my words didn't sound forced. "Fall is such a busy time." My husband Eric and I had gone to this church for 8 years now. We felt comfortable here. Yet, we never joined any group, Bible study, nothing. We'd kept our distance in that respect. Or at least I had. My 15-year-old son, Nathan, sat at a table with the other teens in the group. I overheard one of them say, "You have brothers and sisters?" I held my breath, wondering how Nathan would respond. But he simply said, "I have two brothers and two sisters, but they're older than I am. I'm the only one who still lives at home." I exhaled with relief, and yet that voice I could never completely silence persisted in whispering, "What will people think if they knew? What will they say?" Eric and I had been happily married for 17 years after difficult first marriages. We'd each brought two kids to our marriage, then had Nathan together. Being divorced wasn't some big scandal. I knew that. Unfortunately, it was all too common. And yet, I lived in fear that if the people at the church knew, they'd treat me differently, that I'd be judged, found wanting. I wanted so badly to feel truly part of a church family, to feel as if I belonged. But there was a part of me that just couldn't risk opening up. And that was the whole point of a life group, isn't it? I'd grown up in a church feeling accepted. Every week we were one of the last families to leave after the Sunday service. My father was a deacon. My parents' closest friends were church friends. They were there for all the big events in my life. All that changed after my parents' divorce. I was then in my early 20s and living a few hours away, but I saw how people treated my mom. Our family used to be part of the in crowd, the ones who were always counted on to help with the potluck dinners and vacation Bible school. But no one called mom after that. She was shunned. Judged. Mom drifted away from church and eventually stopped going altogether. I couldn't blame her. Then came my own divorce. I wasn't about to let the same thing happen to me. I learned my lesson after I told the woman at church I was attending how my marriage fell apart. She practically turned her back on me, at least figuratively. "Judge not, lest ye be judged." Right. If I really wanted that closeness I had known with my church family growing up, I would have to be vigilant about what I shared and not give people a reason to judge or reject me. Now I was asking myself, what on earth had prompted me to join this life group? "It's about deepening our connections," said the woman who reached out to invite Eric and me to the group. "It's about growing closer to Christ and supporting each other." That's what I had been wanting for years, to feel that connection, that closeness. "I can share," I thought. "It's not as if I have to tell them everything." I was too late to back out, and besides, what would people say? I'd be judged for that, too. After that first Tuesday night, the life group met every week. We took turns bringing dinner for the group, After eating, the adults did a faith-based study, usually about parenting or marriage, while the teens hung out. Nathan loved it. It gave him a night with his closest friends. Eric and I enjoyed getting to know everyone, but we didn't share anything about our past marriages. I never lied. The subject never came up directly, and I never volunteered more than necessary. That didn't prevent me from feeling as if I were walking a high wire. Still, as the weeks went on, I felt myself growing closer to the other couples in the group. That March, another couple, Brandon and Katie, invited us to go out to the Olive Garden for dinner. I was twirling spaghetti onto my fork when Katie said they'd be celebrating 17 years of marriage in June. "Really? What day?" I asked. "Our anniversary is June 30th. We're June 16th, but you and Eric have been married longer than 17 years. I shook my head, and Katie immediately apologized. "I just assumed because you guys are older that we are..." Eric jumped in. "This is a second marriage for both of us. Our first marriages ended very painfully, but they taught us some important lessons. God helped us see these lessons. Diane and I appreciate each other so much more, and we work hard to keep our relationship healthy. Honestly, I think we have a better marriage now than we would have if we'd married each other fresh out of college." In all our years of marriage, I'd never heard Eric say these words, not quite like this. And while he was talking to Brandon and Katie, there was a part of me that knew the words were meant for me too, maybe especially for me. Brandon nodded thoughtfully. "That makes sense," he said, "and it's obvious that you guys are really happy together." "That's the important part," Katie added. Eric squeezed my hand under the table, and the conversation moved on to a discussion about our kids. Without a single awkward moment, we were just two couples sharing honestly with each other. Afterward, when Eric and I got in the car, I said, "Thank you for saying what you did and how you said it. I didn't feel judged at all." Eric glanced at me and smiled. "Did you really think you would be?" His question stayed with me after we got home. Why did I care so much what people thought of me? Why did I always think I was being judged? My divorce was a major trigger, understandably, but it went deeper than just a failed marriage. Sometimes I feared being a failed person. I didn't get the most positive reinforcement as a kid, especially from my dad. I always felt that he found me wanting, not serious, that I just didn't live up to the expectations he never actually articulated. I grew up in the shadow of his disappointment in me and feeling I was being judged and found inadequate without ever understanding why. After he left my mom, he made little effort to maintain a relationship with me. Eric did not share my fear of being judged. I realized he knew that the only judgment that mattered was God's, and God judged with love. Now I wondered if, deep down, I feared I was a disappointment to God, as if when my first marriage failed, I had failed him. And yet, what Eric had said, that God had brought us together to heal us from our past, was so true, I felt as if I were understanding it for the very first time. How could I fear judgment when God loved me that much? I had to trust that love and to be honest about myself and stop hiding. I could start with our life group. At our next life group meeting, we watched a video on how to handle finances as a couple. During the discussion time, I asked a question I hoped would give me the opening I wanted. Do you keep your money separate or together? Most of the couples said they combine their finances. Then it was my turn. I took a deep breath and said, keeping our money in one account was really hard for me because this is my second marriage. It was hard to combine everything right away because I'd experienced so much loss. I really struggled financially when I was a single mom, and I was afraid of being in that situation again. I had to ask God to help me trust Eric and not hold my past hurts against him. I looked around the table and made eye contact with one of the men in the group. He had the kindest expression on his face. "I never knew you guys went through that," he told us. "I bet that was really hard, and I'm so impressed you found the strength to trust each other." Everyone else was nodding in agreement. There was no judgment in anyone's eyes, just understanding and acceptance. It had taken me 8 months of weekly meetings to trust that these people were the church family God had led me to, and that I could trust them to love me, despite my very imperfect past and my very imperfect self. God didn't want me to be perfect. He just wanted me to be who he made me to be. In May 2024, our life group had to decide whether to continue our weekly meetings for another year or separate and join different groups at church. I prayed that everyone else would feel the way I did. We voted unanimously to keep our group together. The other couples asked Eric and me to lead the group. Tuesdays are my favorite day of the week. Sundays are pretty great, too. Our car is one of the last to leave the parking lot after services. There was an advertising campaign a few years ago for a national fitness chain that proclaimed its gyms were a judgment-free zone, so people wouldn't feel self-conscious, I guess. That's what I want church to be like and my life to be like, too. The next story is under Generation to Generation, High Fidelity by Jenny Ivy of Cookeville, Tennessee. On Sundays, when my great-grandmother could no longer make it to church, she cranked up Tennessee Ernie Ford's all-time greatest hymns, and it wasn't because she was hard of hearing. I rifled through the beat-up cardboard box filled with music CDs, looking for something to play on an upcoming car trip. At the bottom, beneath the classic country and classic rock, I found an album I hadn't come across in years, Tennessee Ernie Ford's All-Time Greatest Hymns. My mind harkened back more than a half a century to the cozy suburban house in Augusta, Georgia, where I'd grown up. My family shared our home with my maternal great-grandmother, Jenny Matthews, my namesake. Grandma was well in her 80s when she came to live with us. I was 9. Though she considered herself spry, in truth, it was often hard for her to get around. Her feet were so arthritic, it was sometimes difficult for her to even stand. That didn't matter to either of us because there were plenty of fun things we could do sitting down. I read to her, and she read to me. We played Yahtzee, we played Scrabble, we played cards. We grew a big, messy flower bed. I planted and weeded and watered while Grandma supervised from a lawn chair so we could have beautiful bouquets for the dining table. We watched baseball on the tiny black and white portable TV in her room, which inspired my lifelong love of the game. We ate lunch together whenever I wasn't in school. A bologna and cheese sandwich for me, and day-old cornbread crumbled into a glass of cold buttermilk for her. But my favorite thing to do with Grandma was something we called church at home. Most Sunday mornings, Grandma shook her head when my parents asked if she wanted to accompany us to the little Methodist church in our neighborhood. "I'm too slow and creaky," she'd say. "Y'all go on without me. I'll just have church at home." One Sunday morning, I woke up feeling sick. "Maybe you should stay home with Grandma," my mother said. And so I did. Grandma and I lingered at the breakfast table after everyone else had left. She was daintily sipping the coffee she'd poured into her saucer to cool. "Tell me about the Sunday school class you're missing today," she said. I told her I had lots of friends and that my teacher was nice. "We're learning about John Wesley." Grandma reached across the table to squeeze my hand. "How about you clear the dishes while I get dressed? I'll meet you in the living room in 10 minutes. Sunshine streamed through the windows as Grandma settled into a rocking chair. I plopped down on the couch. She held a writing tablet, a fountain pen, in her lap. "First," she said, "we'll make a list of our worries." I mentioned a long division test coming up and my friend Allison's dog, who had an infected leg. Grandma listed a thunderstorm predicted for later that day and her grandson, who'd just been drafted into the army. We bowed our heads. "Ease our worries, Lord," Grandma prayed. Then we listed our joys. I'd been invited to a skating party that week and had learned to play a new chord on my guitar. Grandma was glad the New York Yankees had won 3 games in a row and that she'd received a letter from her baby sister who lived 300 miles away. Again, we bowed our heads. "Thank you for our many blessings, Lord," Grandma prayed. We said the Lord's Prayer in unison. Then it was time for Bible reading. "Old Testament or New?" Grandma asked me. "Old," I said. "Pharaoh's daughter finds baby Moses in the bulrushes." It was one of my favorite stories, and Grandma knew it. She opened her worn King James Bible. "Now, if I can just remember where to find baby Moses." I couldn't help but giggle. "Exodus, Grandma, chapter 2. She turned to it and handed me the Bible so I could read the first 10 verses aloud. Now it was Grandma's turn to pick something. I knew she had read a New Testament chapter every day. She chose the last part of Matthew 25, in which Jesus talks about feeding the hungry and visiting those who are sick and in prison. Grandma motioned for me to move close so we could read aloud together. Once the praying and the Bible reading were over, the singing began. The record Grandma chose for us was Tennessee Ernie Ford's all-time greatest hymns. I put it on the turntable of the hi-fi stereo that took up one whole wall of our living room and cranked up the volume. Ernie Ford sang "The Old Rugged Cross" and "Bringing in the Sheaves" and "What a Friend We Have in Jesus" and lots of others, with me and Grandma singing along. Then church at home was over, and my parents and my younger brother, Rusty, burst through the front door, laughing and talking and ready for lunch. There were many more Sundays after that when I would stay home from our church, not because I was sick, but just so I could worship with Grandma. My great-grandmother, Jenny, has been gone from this earth for decades now, but she's never far from me. Especially on Sunday mornings when I can't attend church in person. On those mornings, I pray about my worries and thank God for my joys. I read from Grandma's old Bible, one story from the Old Testament and one from the New Testament. And then comes the best part. I play the Tennessee Ernie Ford CD I unearthed, which I'd bought to replace Grandma's beloved record. And Grandma still holds my hand and rocks and sings those dear old hymns along with me. Our next story is about overcoming grief, entitled Remember the Love. There's nothing sweeter than an old dog. That's why saying goodbye is so hard. Here are 8 ways to find healing from our resident pet expert by Peggy Frizen of Rexford, New York. There's a saying, dogs give you some of the best days of your life and one of the worst. That is the day you have to say goodbye. I know because I've lived that worst day numerous times. Most people choose puppies or kittens when they add a pet to the family, but my husband Mike and I rescue senior dogs. It began with an 11-year-old golden retriever on the rescue group's website. For Mike, it was love at first sight. The dog's age gave me pause. He'll break our hearts, I said. But the pull we felt to open our home to this beautiful dog was stronger than my fear. We named the golden Brooks. We had only had 11 months together, but every day felt like a gift. Brooks was gentle and calm. He loved to cuddle and stroll around the block. Asina was a great fit for our quiet lifestyle. It felt good to give a forever home to an older dog who had been abandoned. When we lost Brooks, we found we had room in our hearts and home to rescue another senior dog. Mike and I have done this again and again, finding a profound sense of satisfaction, giving comfort to a creature of God in the final stage of life. But it is necessarily a journey that has made me something of an expert on pet loss and grief. When the time comes to say goodbye, there is no right or wrong way to feel. Here are some suggestions that help me, and I hope will help you. Create a memorial. When Brooks died, we gathered up a couple of photographs, his dog tags, the paw print his vet had made on his last day, and a tuft from his hair, then took them to the frame shop. Is this a memorial? The clerk asked. I hadn't thought of our collection of mementos like that, but it was. It felt cathartic. Now, every time I pass by the display hanging in our upstairs hallway, it comforts me. Some people frame a favorite photo of their pet and place it somewhere special. Others create a memorial with the ashes in an urn or decorative box, surrounded by a photo, candles, and a scripture verse. Another lovely idea is to turn your pet's food or water bowl into a planter. Fill the bowl with pebbles and potting mix, then add succulents. Focus on the life you shared. After Brooks, we adopted an older golden named Ike. Ike's death was unexpected and hit me hard. For weeks, all I could think of was his final day, his pain, our worry, rushing to the vet. Ike had collapsed, it turned out. He had a tumor on his spleen. My mind kept returning to the vet's words, the grim diagnosis, the image of Ike lying still on the gurney. Then one evening, Mike and I scrunched close to the couch and scrolled through pictures and videos of Ike on our laptop. Look at this one, I said. I couldn't help but smile at the photo of Ike chasing a tennis ball. Remember that? Mike said, pointing to an image of Ike greeting him after Mike had come home from a long hospital stay. Ike had been such a comfort to me during the time and to Mike in his recovery. We talked about how Ike had earned his therapy dog certification and how he had such a heart for helping others. He'd been a devoted companion to Kelly, our elderly spaniel, and she deteriorated with canine dementia. Ike was more than his last moments here on earth. God had given us a whole history of wonderful experiences together. Intentionally, spending time with photos and videos helped me focus on the beauty, joy, and love Ike had brought to our lives. Read a comforting book. There are many books that can be healing after you've lost a pet. One of my favorites is I'm Still Here, A Dog's Purpose Forever by Catherine Michon. The angel dog in this story is joyful and free in heaven, yet finds ways to love and guide his humans on earth. Recently, my granddaughters faced the decline of their aging cat, Cinnamon. I wanted to prepare them for the inevitable, so together we read some age-appropriate books. Is it okay to be sad? Grace, age 9, asked. Of course, I said. It's sad that she won't be here to play with you anymore, but you'll always have Cinnamon in your heart. Will we ever see her again? Lily, 7, wanted to know. God loves us, and God loves Cinnamon, I said. I believe we will all be together in heaven someday. Lily nodded and gave me a hug. For many children, the loss of a pet is their first experience with death. Reading and talking about it can help them work through their emotions. Find peace in nature. Mike and I enjoy walking the trails and paths we used to take our dogs. The exercise is good for us, and I feel close to God and His creation while out in nature. Hold a service. Not everyone can relate to your grief when you lose a pet. A memorial service offers you time to be among people who understand your feelings and to share memories of your pet. My friend Cynthia held a service for her dog, Namaste. 40 friends and their pets attended, and a chaplain blessed the pets as they arrived. Everyone stood and shared stories about Namaste. It reminded me of how blessed I was to care for such a beautiful soul, Cynthia told me. I believe God wanted her to do this work in heaven. Help others. Studies have shown that helping others when you're feeling down also helps yourself. Honor the life of your pet by looking for opportunities to touch the lives of other animals. If you have food, crates, beds, or other supplies, donate them to an animal shelter or rescue group. We donated a jar of goodbye kisses to our veterinary office in memory of Ernie. The usually forbidden Hershey's kisses are given only to euthanasia patients. We included a tag that read, because no dog should go to heaven without tasting chocolate. Do something uniquely you. Your pet was one of a kind. Why not commemorate them in a unique way? Consider commissioning an artist to paint a beautiful portrait of your pet. Some companies make personalized books, blankets, or even custom plush animals in your pet's image. Share the love. The best way I've found to heal from my grief is to give a home to another dog, especially one in need. Search your heart, and if you feel you're ready to add a new pet to your family, consider rescuing an animal who needs a forever home. Your new pet is not replacing your departed friend. Instead, they're giving you an opportunity to build a new and sacred bond. Mike and I lost Ernie last year. We still have 2 senior dogs at home, but I know one day, when the time is right, God will send me another senior dog to love who, like their predecessors, will make my life fuller and more joyful every day that we're blessed to have together.
And now we turn to the Reader's Digest for March and April of 2025. Inside, we find a story under the title of Everyday Heroes, a piggyback ride from a stranger. After an elderly woman broke her leg on a hill, a hiker spent hours carrying her down. By Sidney Page. Once a year, Ursula Bannister climbs a high rock lookout, a viewpoint near Ashford, Washington, where she scattered her mother's ashes 23 years ago. She usually hikes with someone along the 3.2-mile trail, and last August, Bannister, then 79, went on her own, figured she'd be fine because she's an experienced hiker. It's steep, so it's considered a hard hike, but because I've done it so many times, I wasn't nervous about it, said Bannister, who lives in Tacoma. She arrived at the trail at around 11 a.m. and made her way to the lookout. As she headed back down, her foot got caught in a hole in the ground, and she fell forward. By the time I sat up, my foot was pointing the wrong way. I knew right away I had broken my leg, Bannister says. She cried out for help, and before long, a stranger approached and called 911. They were told a search and rescue team would arrive in 5 hours. It wasn't very encouraging, Bannister says. I asked this man to please ask anybody if they had painkillers because at that point the pain was pretty substantial. No one in the vicinity did, but two young men came over to see what was going on. When they saw Bannister on the ground in agony, they made an offer. They would carry the injured woman to the bottom of the trail. Troy May, an Air Force airman stationed at Joint Base Lewis-McChord, had hiked up to the lookout that day with his friend Leighton Allen. I knew I was capable of carrying her down, says May, then 20. I really didn't make much of a decision. I just knew I needed to carry her down if I could. May eased Bannister onto his back and started hiking downward. He carried her for most of the nearly three-hour journey, and Allen carried her for the rest. People literally came out of the woods to help me. Others pitched in as well. Shortly into the hike, May, who was wearing cowboy boots, got blisters on the bottom of one foot. A man on the trail saw the situation and gave May his shoes, then continued on with his socks. That was just one kindness, says Bannister. A couple hiking that day also lent a hand. One, a physical therapist, bandaged Bannister's foot and built a makeshift splint for her leg out of wooden scraps. The other, an occupational therapist, did breathing exercises with her to help her calm. I was just overwhelmed with gratitude that these people literally came out of the woods to help me, she said. During the long hike down, her rescuers shared stories and asked Bannister about her own life to distract her from the mounting pain. She told them about her childhood in Germany and what it was like to move to the United States in 1959 when she was 14. Their efforts to distract her worked, Bannister says. If I didn't focus on my pain, I didn't scream quite as loudly, she said. Once they reached the parking lot, Allen drove Bannister to the Tacoma General Hospital, about 2 hours away, and May followed them in his car. At the hospital, Bannister learned that she had broken her leg in three places, tibia, fibula, and heel bone. The emergency team was very impressed by the splint that the therapist had built, said Bannister, adding that the doctor had told her the damage likely would have been much worse had she waited longer to get medical attention. She arrived home that night at 1 a.m. with crutches and had to wait a week for the swelling to go down before she could undergo emergency surgery. I am now the proud owner of 11 screws and a titanium plate in my leg, Bannister says. During her recovery, the people who helped her down the High Rock Lookout have checked in several times. I think we'll be friends for a really long time, Bannister said. And now, from the Glad to Hear It section of the Reader's Digest, three stories to make your day. Finding Andorra. In 2022, Brenda Denmark's gray pit bull Andorra went missing. Had Andorra been stolen from her backyard in Pensacola, Florida? Had she wandered off? Was she even alive? Denmark was heartbroken 2 years later and some 900 miles away in Enid, Oklahoma. Destiny Drews found a gray pit bull with no tags. She had it scanned with a microchip ID scanner and the name popped up, Andorra. She filed an online found pet report and from there linked up with the owner. Denmark and her husband pulled into Drews' driveway at 1 a.m. after driving 14 straight hours. Andorra approached Denmark tentatively, took a few sniffs, and then a tail wag. Soon she was on her back demanding belly rubs. They wanted her baby home. Drews told KFOR in Oklahoma, "I've never seen somebody love their dog so much." The next piece is titled, The Accidental Helper. When Burnsville, North Carolina was devastated by Hurricane Helene last September, pilots and government agencies seeking to help were given a number to call. It belonged to Stephanie Carlson, who lived 2 hours away and had nothing to do with emergency rescue, had never heard of Burnsville, and had no idea why she was getting the calls. But that didn't stop her from stepping up. She heard from FEMA, the FAA, and the National Guard, even the Air Force. They were all looking to give or get information and assumed Carlson was a go-to person. Carlson was not, but she collected the information and shared it with the proper agencies, in some cases saving the lives of people trapped in floodwaters. "We all have to do what we can in situations like this," she told WX11 News in Winston-Salem. The next piece, The Music Man. David Furzig, a University of Vermont music professor, has flown around the world giving piano concerts. But disturbed by his growing carbon footprint from all of the air travel, he's sticking around Vermont, playing free classical and jazz concerts in what he calls his Play Every Town project. That means he's driving his electric vehicle to every corner of the state, playing at 256 churches, meeting houses, cafes, and small venues. Driving, not flying, has given him a deeper appreciation of what his state, he told the Wall Street Journal, "It's amazing to see what we have here." The next story is under the Life Well Lived section. The best guy I know. When Uncle George calls, it's always worth picking up. By Tommy Marcus. My Uncle George lives in a home with a few other people like him. He enjoys a simple life. No smartphones, no internet, so communications is limited to in-person and old-school landline phone calls. He has a girlfriend, Carol, and they got married about once every 2 weeks. He tells me she thinks I'm handsome, and I tell him to tell her a thank you. It's not clear whether Carol exists. My uncle and I have always shared a special bond, and my middle name, George, is a point of pride. Still, when I was around 5 years old, I asked my parents what was wrong with him. I was five, okay? Delicacy wasn't my strong suit. Anyway, they said nothing was wrong with him exactly, but that Uncle George was mentally disabled. Back in the day, George would periodically ask for my cell phone number and write it down. He'd call a bunch of times and then abruptly stop, because he had lost the piece of paper with my number on it. This went on for years until at some point around 6 years ago, he committed my number to memory. ever since then, about once an hour from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., he calls me 10 times a day without fail, 365 days a year. Though I love him quite a bit, I answer maybe two of those phone calls a day. Our phone calls always follow the same structure, using one of three fantasy realities, courtesy of George's imagination. In one, he's my dad and I'm his son. In the role, he enjoys scolding me for cursing. In another, he's Major Charles Winchester from the 1970s TV show MASH. And I'm Captain B.J. Honeycutt, reporting for duty. In the last, we're both lifeguards strategizing the rescue of a drowning person. When the phone rings, I always say hello, as if I don't know who it is calling. "Hi, George," I'll say. "It's your dad, George," or "It's Major Winchester," or "This is the Tower 1, Tower 2, can you read me?" We go back and forth in character for about a minute and a half, only breaking the bit to laugh hysterically, then go quiet. "You know something, Tommy," he'll say, "I'm just calling to say you're the best guy I know." "So are you," I replied. "The two of us, the two musketeers, all for one and one for all." We both laugh. Then he'll ask what I'm eating for dinner, and or if I'll watch the Mets game, and wrap up telling me how he'll call me back at a specific time. He always calls back earlier than he says he will. The conversation has been repeated verbatim multiple times a day for years now. No matter what's going on in the world, no matter how shaky life's underpinnings, the consistency of these calls is something I can count on. At my most stressed and vulnerable, angry and sad during painful breakups and professional setbacks, that phone call nevertheless rolls in, allowing me to escape reality for a bit and just laugh and act like I was a kid again. Because George doesn't understand things at an adult level, he has no idea what I do for work. For example, it's impossible for him to comprehend certain aspects of my life or truly attune to whatever I'm having a good or a bad day. Instead, he's able to bring me the same energy, the same love and acceptance no matter what. It's an incredible gift because I know that even at my worst, when I feel like I'm drowning, I can count on Uncle George up there in Tower 1 to call down from his perch through his mighty megaphone and tell me I'm the best guy he knows. It's an act of love that saves me just a bit every single day.
Our next article is under Health. RX mistakes pharmacists want you to quit making. For starters, take your pills out of the medicine cabinet, by Jan C. Dunn from the New York Times. I recently visited my parents and I was ransacking their kitchen for snacks when I noticed something. Their medications were in their cabinet near the oven. "Keeping your meds there isn't ideal," I told my dad. "You're cooking all the time and it's hot." "I'm sure it's fine," my father said. Then he looked at me warily. "You're going to ask some experts, aren't you?" he asked. "Tell Mom and Dad that's not a good idea," said Miriam Shaw Ohea, an assistant professor of pharmacy, practice, and science at Ohio State University's College of Pharmacy. "Storing medications near a heat source may reduce its effectiveness," she explained. "My parents aren't the only ones who assume that one safekeeping spot is as good as another. Less than a quarter of the participants in the 2021 study done by the University of Minnesota were storing their medications appropriately. And improper storage is just one of the many mistakes that people make. Here, pharmacists share their best tips for properly filling, storing, and discarding prescription drugs. Take your meds out of the bathroom cabinet. Just as storing pills near a heat generating kitchen appliance can reduce their effectiveness, keeping them in a bathroom cabinet is also a bad idea, says Mary Bridgman, a clinical professor at the Ernest Mario School of Pharmacy at Rutgers University. The term medicine cabinet is a total misnomer, she says. Steam from your bathroom can erode the coatings on medications, and heat can break down the active ingredients, says Eric McLaughlin, the chair of the Pharmacy Practice Department at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center. The kitchen can be a good spot, he said, as long as you're storing your medication in a cool, dry place that's away from temperature fluctuations. McLaughlin also warns that medications should be stowed away from children and pets. Many oral medications should be kept at temperatures between 68 and 77 degrees, according to the United States Pharmacopeia, an independent nonprofit organization that sets drug quality standards. Check the patient leaflet that comes with the medication for storage instructions, McLaughlin suggests. Learn how to take your medications properly. You may think you know how to take a pill or use an insulin pen, but research suggests that half the prescription medications taken in the United States are used improperly. People may skip a pill, take a medication at the wrong time, or stop taking it without asking their doctors. So, in addition to asking about any side effects, go over the instructions for use, including what to do if you skip a dose, suggests Shaw O'Hea. It's a human nature thing, she says. We just go out of the pharmacy and think, I know how to use this. If you're unsure how to administer something, like an insulin pen or an injectable, ask the pharmacist to give you a demonstration. Otherwise, she says, some patients will inject their medication in the wrong part of their body, insert a suppository with the foil on, or overuse an inhaler. And if you crush pills because you have trouble swallowing them, let your pharmacist know, McLaughlin adds. Some medications have a time-release coating or other mechanism to release an active ingredient more slowly. If you crush them, you can basically get your entire dose at one time, he says. Review your medications. Go over your medications periodically to make sure that all of them are still necessary and meet your current needs, Bridgman says. Also tell your doctor about any vitamins or supplements you are taking. If you have Medicare with a drug coverage plan, she adds, you may be eligible for a service called Medication Therapy Management. This allows you to review all your medications with a pharmacist or healthcare provider. It's free, and you'll also get a written summary of your medications that you can take to your doctor or to an emergency room. See if you qualify at medicare.gov/drug coverage Part D. Ask about prices. You might be able to save some money with one simple inquiry. Ask your pharmacist whether there's a generic drug or a coupon available. McLaughlin suggests, sometimes the manufacturers have coupons that the pharmacy can apply to the person's copay, he says. In a Consumer Reports investigation, secret shoppers are sometimes able to negotiate a discount when they asked, is that really the best price you can offer? You can also ask, McLaughlin says, and they can always say no, but they might just say yes. Get rid of old drugs the right way. It may seem convenient to flush unused or expired drugs down the toilet, but they can end up in our water supply, McLaughlin says, and wastewater treatment plants aren't designed to remove them, according to the Environmental Protection Agency. So you want to dispose of these medications in a responsible manner. The Drug Enforcement Administration offers a National Prescription Drug Take-Back Day twice yearly in April and October. If you don't want to wait, many pharmacies have secure drop boxes for expired drugs, Shaw says. To find a year-round collection site near you, search DEA year-round drop-off locations or call 800-882-9539. If you can't get to one of these locations, the Food and Drug Administration has these instructions for disposing of drugs in the trash. Mix medicines. Do not crush tablets or capsules with an unpalatable substance such as dirt, cat litter, or used coffee grounds. Place the mixture in a sealed plastic bag or other container and throw it in the trash. Use a marker to obscure all personal information on your prescription label, making it unreadable, then toss the container into the recycling. I told my parents that Professor Shaw recommended that they move their medications, so they transferred them to a pantry next to some soup cans. During my visit, I also pointed out that the minestrone had passed its sell-by date. My dad sighed and said, "Please don't call the experts." Under the section on the healthy world of medicine, a juicy swap for sports drinks. Researchers at German Sport University Cologne compared water, a sports drink, and diluted cloudy apple juice for their effectiveness at providing energy for runners. They found that the apple juice provided the same energy as a sports drink, with the benefit of being less irritating to the digestive system. While both drinks contain the same amount of sugar, which is important for keeping energy levels up during workouts, the apple juice allowed the intestinal lining to recover more quickly. And easy on the earbuds. While noise-canceling earbuds and headphones are great for improving focus and relaxation, wearing them for too long at high volumes can strain your ears and cause long-term hearing damage. Listening at 80% volume for a maximum of 90 minutes at a time is the general rule, says Sharon Sandridge, PhD, audiologist and staff at the Cleveland Clinic. She notes that if someone standing an arm's length away can hear your music, or if you have to raise your voice to speak while listening, the volume is too loud. Earbuds can foster bacterial growth, notes Katie Dees, a doctor of audiology with the Mayo Clinic, potentially leading to infections such as swimmer's ear. Both earbuds and headphones collect sweat, skin cells, and sebum, so clean them regularly with alcohol wipes. Diabetes drugs for dementia. A Korean study has found that a type of oral diabetes drug called SGLT2 inhibitor, prescribed to lower blood sugar in adults with type 2 diabetes, for example, Jardiance, can lower the risk of developing dementia and Parkinson's disease. The researchers from Seoul's Yonsei University College of Medicine looked at data from hundreds of thousands of patients over about 4 years and found that the drugs reduced the risks of these neurodegenerative disorders in both men and women by about 20%. This type of drug increases the amount of sugar excreted in the urine, raising the body's level of substances called ketones, which benefit from the nervous system. In need of iron. A new study at Brigham and Women's Hospital finds that nearly 1 in 3 Americans have an undiagnosed iron deficiency. While a mild deficiency of this essential mineral might not cause any symptoms, as the condition continues, it may lead to fatigue, weakness, and breathlessness. Eventually, it might progress to iron deficiency anemia, a condition where the blood doesn't contain enough healthy red cells. Anyone concerned about a change in energy levels or other possible symptoms should ask their doctor if a lack of iron could be the cause. The usual treatments are supplements and eating iron-rich foods such as meat, poultry, fish, eggs, and dark leafy greens.
And now a quip from Merriam-Webster, titled, "This Spells Trouble." Some of the most commonly misspelled words in the English challenge us to remember when to use a double letter and when not to. For example, accommodate and committee have more double letters than we think is right. Broccoli flaunts its double C's yet insists on keeping a single I, even though we're used to seeing those in pairs. Zucchini behaves similarly, but it throws an H in there too. And we have to address the word itself. Misspell has two S's, one for the miss and one for the spell. Words sometimes drop a dupe in a case like this, but misspell hangs on to both its S's, hissing at us to pay attention. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening, and we hope to catch up with you next month.